You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
No, it isn't too promising for Jerry. But after all, it's no compliment to any girl to call her so late she thinks she's a very last resort.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 197 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Jason Kleberg from Force 5 to discuss a 1987 film, or is it a 1992 film, from one of the most celebrated directors of the 1970s, starring Michael Biehn and Alex MacArthur, directed by William Friedkin. It's Rampage. But first...
This is a story about...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream, and other good things to eat.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor, served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
In this remote little country village, the mortal remains of a man are laid to rest.
Who is it this time, Peter?
It's Mr. Spaulding. They found him this morning. Just like the others.
Just like the others, he died in the night.
Get away from there! Get away!
suddenly, violently, horribly.
This is an evil place. Corrupt and evil.
Evil, as venomous as a snake, turns the quiet of this village into a writhing hell on earth, where every man fears for his safety and his sanity, where everyone is suspect.
What do you mean they died by some sort of magic, some witchcraft?
For the first time in my life, I'm frightened.
Everyone is frightened. The doctor who'd lived his life in the East. This man who could be the next victim. This woman and this girl are frightened, hypnotized by the crawling, creeping spell of the reptile.
Stop!
Pack your things, we're leaving.
No, Dr. Franklin. You are not leaving.
I could kill you.
Possibly. But you could never be free then, could you? And what would happen to little Anna then?
Trapped like animals in a cage and getting closer and closer, suffocating them with terror. The reptile.
And now, on with the show.
Charles, I'm Dr. Benjamin Ketty. I'm a psychiatrist. I was engaged by your attorney here, Mr. Morse. I've gone over your psychological tests and your magnetic resonance scan, and I think your best defense is insanity. Now, Mr. Morse and I will have to convince the jury of your condition. So we need you to help us understand it.
You see?
I don't want an insanity defense. Everything I did was justified. I had to do it. It was all up to me.
Did something tell you to do those things?
What do you mean?
Well, for example, did something tell you to go out and shoot people?
Yeah. I don't know what it was. What do you think it was?
Well, that's for you to tell me, Charles.
I hear voices on the radio sometimes.
What sort of voices, Charles?
Music. Telling me to kill. There's this one station I listen to. It's a devil station. I listen and I'd hear Satan telling me to kill. Sometimes I think this isn't real. These aren't really messages. It's not making any sense. Then finally I figured it must be true. So then when I started to lose all my blood, I figured that it was Satan poisoning me for not keeping my end of the bargain.
Do you remember going into a woman's house the day you were arrested?
She was making trouble, and her dog was poisoned.
How did you feel after you killed these people?
Just kind of delirious. I didn't care.
Well, how did you pick out this particular family to kill?
I don't know. It was just an accident.
An accident? What do you mean?
It's just no reason, you know? I just walked up to the door and the woman opened the door and so I shot her right then.
What happened to the little boy?
Oh, I put him in the trash can with the lid in the garbage someplace.
Was he still alive?
I don't know. I might have shot him a couple of times.
You killed him?
No, I sucked some blood. And then I got rid of it.
I'm confused, Charlie, as to how you could hurt people. A small child who never did you any harm.
Well, I never meant to hurt him. I needed his blood. Well, I feel bad about it now, I guess.
But not then.
Oh, no, not then.
Okay, our movie this time is Rampage from 1987, and joining me to discuss this film is Jason Kleberg from Force 5. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on here talking about some Rampage.
Yes, yes. We should mention, too, this is 1987 Rampage. This is not The Rock Rampage.
Oh, really? I'm confused. I watched the wrong movie.
Oh, man. Well, I tell you, that video game that it's based on, that was my go-to game at Showbiz Pizza when I was a kid. So would have been great, but that's not what we're talking about this time. But before we get to that movie, why don't you take a moment here, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do over there on your show.
Sure. So Force 5 is a podcast where I force a different guest every single show to come up with a movie-themed top five list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. The topic is always up to the guest, and I never know what they've picked until we're revealing it on air. It's just a real fun format, and I've got a swath of different types of guests, from other podcasters to directors to writers. I've even had a professional wrestler on there, just like a ton of different people on there. It's been really fun to get different perspectives on movies. You know, there's like, you get a top five list topic, like top five car chases, for example, and you think in your head, well, we're definitely going to have three of the same five, but it's almost always different because people just have these, you know, different watch patterns. And yeah, it's amazing to see what recommendations I come away with.
Yeah, I love those kinds of formats, you know, hearing what people rank as their top five, top 10, whatever. Though I admit it always intimidates me a little bit when I participate in those types of things, because part of me doesn't want to just limit myself, you know, and be like, these are my five. And also, I'm always scared that I'm going to like get halfway through things and then go, oh, how did I forget that one? I'll feel like a complete idiot there. But
happens every time. Trust me, it's the life of the top fiver. And sometimes I'll have recorded an episode, and between when it's recorded and when it airs, I'll watch something that would have been perfect on the list, and I just kick myself for not having watched it earlier. Literally just happened last show.
Well, but you're absolutely right that, you know, depending on who you've got there, I mean, you're always going to see different things, you know, no matter how worried you are that you're going to come up with the same things. I've found when I've participated in things like that, I'm amazed at the variety we get. Go on the Lambcast with the Large Association of Movie Blogs, and we'll do top five lists. In fact, we just recorded a few days ago as we're recording this one where we did our top fives from 1978. And it wasn't just, you know, everybody didn't do necessarily their favorite movies, but we do it kind of in a format that works for each of us. One guy did, you know, what he considered to be the best films, and another guy did his favorite films that he saw at a certain theater in 78 when he was a kid. And I do top five forgotten films from 78, things like that. So you get a wide variety. It's always a lot of fun. I always come out of those things with lists of things that I still need to watch, you know.
Oh man, my watch list is incredibly long right now, and I slowly chip away at it, and then the next show I get like three more recommendations. It's tough.
Are there times though where you've ever had like a topic and then you kind of get into it and you're going, boy, what was I thinking with this topic? You know, I'm having trouble finding five things that I think really need to be highlighted here.
You know, the toughest one that I've had to come up with a good five film list was top five video game adaptations.
Oh,
David Rosen from Piecing It Together. And he comes up with the topic and I'm like, yeah, that's going to be exciting. That's going to be fun. And then I really start rewatching some movies and going through my Blu-ray collection. And then I realize, whoa, it's really not easy to come up with five great video game adaptations. So that was probably the toughest one. But people come up with off the wall stuff. I mean, Eric Peacock from Soundtracker had one of the tougher ones, which was top five one-hit wonders in film. So they were like artists that had only had a one hit and they came from a film. And those were that was a real tough list. There's no way to research something like that. You really got to dig deep, you know?
Oh, so you're talking about songs from the films or like actors and actresses that were one-hit wonders?
No, we're talking in that case, it was songs from the films.
Oh, wild.
So it's like that one person that made a theme song one time on an album and never had an album of their own outside of that movie. And yeah, that was that was the toughest one to research, I think.
I'm going to have to dig back and find that because I love movie soundtracks, especially from the 80s. I've got a ongoing playlist where, you know, just anytime I find an obscure song from an 80s movie, I've got to plug it into my playlist. And that's the section I'm always in when I go to the record store. I'm always digging through the vinyl of the soundtracks, trying to find, those old obscure 80s movie soundtracks. So yeah, that sounds great.
Oh, yeah. You know, we've done top five scores on the program, but I've never done top five soundtracks. Nobody's ever proposed it. So,
oh,
maybe someday.
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's get going with this movie that we have here today. And actually, before we get too deep into this movie, let's just throw out here first that this is a film directed by William Friedkin. And of course, William Friedkin is a big name, you know, I guess you could say, having directed a number of films that are generally considered to be certifiable classics, you know, things like The Exorcist and The French Connection and Sorcerer are the three that pop into my mind first. You know, there's others that people throw out there as well, like To Live and Die in L.A. Cruising certainly has its fan base. But at the same time, I mean, nobody bats a thousand. And, you know, Friedkin certainly had some other things there, like Jade, Deal of the Century with Chevy Chase. And we actually covered another Friedkin film on this show many moons ago, a film called The Guardian, about a couple who hire a nanny that is a happens to be an evil tree spirit or something like that. It's been a while. But I guess before we jump into this movie, I want to get your thoughts just on Friedkin and his work. You know, he passed away recently, and believe it or not, listeners, we actually planned this episode several weeks before his passing, so it was not where we are trying to capitalize on that at all. This just kind of happened this way. But before we get to this film, I guess, what is your take on Friedkin in general?
I think Friedkin was a genius. Obviously, like you said, he didn't bat a thousand, but when you have a film like Sorcerer, and that's like third on many people's lists, if you're doing a top five for Friedkin, that's an incredible career. What's your favorite Friedkin movie?
I think if I was to go favorite, I probably would still go The Exorcist. Yeah. Sorcerer was actually a fairly recent watch for me, just in the last couple of years. It's one that I was like, you know, I need to watch this. I haven't pulled the trigger yet, and I need to.
Sure.
And it was just, it blew me away. You know, it was just wild.
Sorcerer's an incredible movie. It's an incredible movie. And the reason that it's not bigger, in my opinion, number one, it's got a terrible title. And number two, it came out the same weekend that Star Wars did. So, of course, it was going to be buried. If that thing comes out a year later or a year before, it is known as a classic everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I look at those films, I don't know. There's so many things that just stick in your mind. You know, all these different moments that Friedkin just etches into your brain. And I guess The Exorcist is a prime example of that type of thing. And, you know, when I think of that film, you know, everybody talks about it as being one of the scariest movies ever made and all that. But for me, the scariest moment of The Exorcist, and I think this shows just what a great director Friedkin was, is not those iconic scenes with the exorcism and, you know, the pea soup and whatever. The hospital scene in The Exorcist is what terrifies me the most.
Yeah, I mean, he has so many moments like that in all of his films. I don't know if you've ever seen Killer Joe from 2011.
I have not. That is one of my blind spots for Friedkin.
Okay, well, let me tell you, when you watch that, you'll never look at a chicken wing the same way again. And my personal favorite Friedkin film is actually not The French Connection or Sorcerer or The Exorcist. It's To Live and Die in L.A. There's just so many pieces that stick out from that movie. The third act is one of the most exciting sequences in film ever. And again, there's so many moments in that last act of To Live and Die in L.A. that just live in my head rent-free all the time. He was just a great manipulator of his audience. And plus, when he passed away, we missed a great film personality. If you've ever seen his interviews, he's incredibly honest. He does not care who he offends. He's like, if this person is offended and they don't want to work with me again, I don't care. And that was just so great about him. He had no filter, and he lets it show in every interview.
Yeah, yeah. He will be missed. Luckily, we can always go back and look at the films. So let's go back and look at this one that a lot of people have looked at. it is very much a forgotten film. So this film, it deals with a young man named Charles Reese, who's played by Alex MacArthur. And, well, this young man has some issues. I mean, basically, as the film begins, we see him go to a house where he proceeds to shoot an elderly couple, and he then drags their adult daughter upstairs, kills her, mutilates her, and drinks her blood. Now, most of this happens off screen, but we do see the very bloody aftermath. Now, enter into this story District Attorney Anthony Frazier, played by Michael Biehn, and he is out to stop this killer before he can kill again. Now, unfortunately, Reese does strike again, killing a suburban mother and one of her young sons. It's another grisly crime, but it does lead to some clues that help the police to zero in on Reese. And after a little bit of a chase, they do manage to capture him. Now comes the difficult process of the trial, and Frazier, who was previously very against the death penalty, has to deal with coming to terms with the fact that they're going to be seeking execution for this monster. He also has to deal with a number of other things going on around him. The husband of the mother who was killed, he's played by Royce Applegate, he doesn't want to be involved. He doesn't want to testify. He just wants to move on with his life. And of course, this is impacting things for the district attorney. Meanwhile, we also have the crafty defense attorney played by Nicholas Campbell, who's making things difficult as he and his team seek to prove that Reese should be found not guilty by reason of insanity. Plus, Frazier must deal with his own demons surrounding the death of his young daughter just a few months before all of this. Now, like we said, this is very much a forgotten film when it comes to Friedkin, and it didn't get a whole lot of a release. In fact, it had kind of a strange history to it, because this was filmed, well, like I said, originally it was intended for 1987 release, but when it actually got released was several years later, because the film, it was made right at a time when the production company, Dino De Laurentiis's company, was having big financial problems, and they actually ended up going bankrupt. And so this film kind of got lost in the shuffle of that. It did have a screening at a film festival in Boston. It screened in Stockton, California, which is where it was shot. But otherwise, it was shelved for many years, until it was eventually picked up by Miramax and had a very small release then in 1992. And I believe it had some changes. There are multiple versions of the film floating out there, and it's very possible that we may have watched different versions. I think the one that I watched is what they usually consider the U.S. release that Miramax did in 1992, but I know there's a European version out there that's a bit different. I guess we'll get into that as we go on here. But yeah, I'm going to let Jason get us started on this one. Give us a few of your thoughts on Rampage.
Yeah, well, I'll start back with the Dino De Laurentiis stuff, because it is interesting. He, in 1986, he had a bunch of hits. Like, if you look at his entertainment group, he starts with Arnold's Raw Deal, and then he does Michael Mann's Manhunter, Blue Velvet, King Kong Lives was a really big hit for them. And in 87, he had Evil Dead 2, but for every hit, there were quite a few misses. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Million Dollar Mystery or From the Hip.
Yep,
Weeds, yep. With Nick Nolte. Like, every one of those was a huge miss. And when Rampage was supposed to come out, they were down like $15 million. And they worked as their both the producer and distributor, so there was just no way to get this film out. And that's why it was shelved. So the way to understand which version you watch, if you turn the film on and it has the Miramax logo, you're watching the U.S. cut. If you don't have that Miramax logo, you're watching the 87 cut. And the 92 cut was recut by Friedkin because of his views on the death penalty changing. So he actually charged like $600K to recut the film for 92 for that release. Mm. It's never been on disc. It's only been on VHS in the U.S. There was a DVD in Poland that was released. That is the Miramax cut. And then there's a Japanese Laserdisc that has the 1987 cut, and that's the one that I watched. I've seen both, so I've seen I've seen the differences, but we'll go over some of those, especially when it comes to the ending, because that's where it gets real, real different.
Yeah.
And I've also read the script, so there are some things that were completely left on the cutting room floor that didn't make it in, including a subplot about Michael Biehn's career. But one of the reasons that I chose this, I love Friedkin. I was very shocked that there was a Friedkin movie that I hadn't heard of. A listener clued me into it. And it was filmed in Stockton, and I lived in Stockton, California for like 8 years. So getting to see all those locations from 1987 is always really fun, you know, those time capsule movies. But I did not go in expecting, like, I watch every movie blind. I don't watch trailers or anything for new movies, old movies, until I've seen them. And I had no idea what this was going to be about. And when it started out, I thought it was going to be, okay, this is a serial killer movie. And then it quickly switches to a courtroom drama film. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really prepared for that. But I still like the film a lot. It's just a weird, it's kind of a weird tone. And I think that the 87 version is better than the 92 version. But we'll get to that when we talk about the ending.
Mm. Well, I definitely watched the 92 version because, like I say, there was a, you know, the Miramax logo like you were talking about. And that's what's out there. You can rent it on Amazon and such. That's how I did it. And what you were saying about not being prepared for it to switch from being like a serial killer movie to a courtroom drama, I wasn't expecting that at all either. I was fully expecting that this was going to be your typical kind of serial killer movie scenario where it's basically all about the hunt. We're trying to find this guy. And there is a portion of this movie that is about that, but that lasts all of about 30 minutes. And then that's done. And it pretty much focuses to a courtroom type of thing. And I got to admit, I'm not completely sure how I feel about this movie. I think I'm kind of going into this recording thinking, I don't know, my brain's still a little fluffy on it. It might change a little bit as we go here, because it certainly didn't wow me. I will say that. And, you know, kind of, you know, thinking in terms of the hallmarks of Friedkin's career, I think, you know, you could, if you watch this up against something like The French Connection or Sorcerer or The Exorcist, you're going, wow, this is the same guy. Oh, my goodness.
Of course.
I've seen some people describe the feel of this as being kind of, I don't know, lacking flair, lacking some style, and almost feeling a little bit like a glorified TV movie. And I can kind of understand that a bit. Where my brain went while I was watching it was I saw it as more like a small regional type production. And what I mean by that is there are films that you run into that are these small productions that, you know, a group of people got together and they got themselves a camera and they said, let's make a movie type of a thing. I've been exposed to some specifically horror movies like this recently because Vinegar Syndrome has released some Blu-rays that they call Hometown Horrors, I think was the name of the sets.
Homegrown Horrors.
Yeah, that's it. And so it's these films that are these small productions that are what they call regional horror films and such. And we actually have here in Denver, Vinegar Syndrome about a year ago opened their kind of western part of the U.S. distribution center here locally. And so, like, if somebody blesses me with a gift card, a lot of times I'll go over there and say, all right, what can I get for my gift card here at the archive? And I picked up those sets, you know. And so this, to me, felt like almost a slightly more polished version of something like that. I mean, it's in this small town, and I say that in quotes, you know, Stockton. I've never been there, but, you know, it's not like
it was
Mayberry,
small in
you know,
87 or small enough. 87. Yeah. It's not so small now.
Yeah. But still, it's got this very kind of local feel to it. And you get the impression watching this, that this was kind of a big deal for the folks that were in this town, because there's a number of scenes where you're going, wow, there's a lot of extras in this scene. It sure looks like everybody in town heard a movie was being made and they showed up so they could be in the movie type of a thing. So I don't know. There was a certain charm to that kind of small regional production type of feel. At the same time, there were many moments where I thought, oh, I think this could have been executed so much better, you know?
Yeah, he had run out of favor with the studios. Sorcerer was really where it started falling apart. That production went way out of control. To Live and Die in L.A. didn't do the numbers that I think everybody was expecting it to do. So this was definitely a smaller film with a smaller budget. I don't understand why they didn't set it in Sacramento versus Stockton. I'm sure it had to do with probably budget constraints, but this is based on a true story of a serial killer who did this in Sacramento. So why they didn't shoot it there, I'm not 100% sure, but it does feel a little bit smaller.
It also kind of surprised me that it was shot in 87, because watching it, it didn't quite feel like an 80s movie to me. If I had just watched this blind, I would have probably said 94, 95, something like that. I don't know. Just the tone of the movie didn't feel 80s to me.
Sure. Yeah. You can definitely see some of Friedkin's style come in, though. Like if you just watch the first 15 minutes of this, well, I guess it kind of depends, because in the 92 version, there's a lot more buildup to the kills. In the 87 version, it gets right into things. Like, right as the opening credits hit, this guy is in somebody's house, knocking on the door and shooting him. Whereas in the 92 version, you see him walking into the hardware store, grabbing a hammer, you know, all this, like, preamble stuff up to the murders.
Yeah, in the version I watched, he goes to, like, an antique store and buys an antique gun. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not in the original version. So it gets right into it, and it's really visceral. And like you said, you don't see much on screen, but the way that it's handled is such that it is still really terrifying. Especially there's a scene when the gentleman walks in with his kid, and his wife is murdered. You don't see really anything as the camera pans to an empty room, and you just hear his screams. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really effective. And that's the moment where it was like, okay, there are some flashes of Friedkin style in here. It just doesn't really happen in those exterior shots at all.
Yeah. Well, and actually in that sequence, you hear the kid screaming first, which that's even more difficult to take. And I mean, I guess that's one of the things that is difficult about this movie, is that it doesn't pull punches when it comes to who our victims are, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, basically,
as you find out soon after that.
Yeah. I mean, we have kids, we have an elderly couple, you know, and it doesn't turn out well for any of them. And especially with the kid. I mean, I don't want to get too gruesome here for the podcast, but one of the images that, was the most disturbing for me was seeing our killer walking around, you know, in the park afterwards, basically, you know, carrying a garbage bag over his shoulder, and you know what's in the garbage bag. You know, it's not pleasant.
Yeah. And the reason, for listeners who haven't seen this, the reason that he's doing this is because he explains that he feels like his blood is poisoned, and his blood is slowly killing his body, and he needs to drink the blood of others in order to keep on living.
Well, and I guess one thing I was going to ask about is how much you buy that story, because that's one of the things that I struggled with a little bit. Was the whole time I'm going through this, especially as the movie starts to focus more on just the idea of, you know, the insanity plea and the death penalty and how those things all work together, et cetera, et cetera. There's a part of me that was going, I don't know if that I fully buy that he's insane and that he's not just saying what he thinks everybody wants him to say so that he can be insane. And maybe part of that is the actor in the role, because he's, you know, I mean, he's a model essentially. I mean, he's just, pretty boy. He's not who you would expect to see as a serial killer. And he's got this look about him, this smirk as he's telling these stories so nonchalantly about, oh yeah, my organs are being poisoned and I must drink the blood and all that stuff. There's a part of me that was going, man, I'm not buying it. You know?
Yeah. And that's where the 87 cut kind of fills in some holes from the 92 cut. So I don't know if you want to get into the end now or if you want to save that for a little bit.
We can definitely get into the end, I think. You know, it's something we're going to bring up eventually anyway, because, you know, there are multiple endings, and that is one of the big differences between the two versions of the film. So I don't have a problem with going ahead and talking about some of those elements now.
All right. So in the 92 cut, near the end of the film, there is a moment with a PET scan for the brain. And in the 92 version, Bean sees the PET scan, and I don't think he says anything, really. This, as it falls into the latter like scene of the movie, he doesn't say anything when he sees the PET scan. In the 87 version, he sees the PET scan, and there are these abnormalities in the brain. So although he was sentenced to death, now Bean sees that the guy actually really was insane. And I think that's one of the big misses of the 92 version, is that there's not that realization for Bean.
Well, and I thought that the film could have actually done a bit more with Bean's character and just his attitudes about the death penalty and such, because there is a sequence where he talks about, you know, that he's against that, and you know, there's no way he wants to go after that. He's doing this because his higher ups are telling him he must. And I don't know, I thought it didn't go far enough with just seeing his own personal conflicts over that.
In the so I don't know how the flashbacks are in the 92 version. In the 87 version, there's a couple of different flashbacks to his young daughter. And I think that the right. switch in that 87 version is when they find the body of another child that he had murdered. That's kind of when he switches from being against it to trying to drive for that. And I haven't seen the 92 version as recently as the 87 version, so I don't know how those flashbacks come through. But I know that there are a lot more in the first cut.
There certainly are those flashbacks in the 92 version, but I didn't see them as much, you know, really kind of being a point where his attitudes changed. If anything, those flashbacks to me almost felt a little bit random. And I was like, okay, this feels to me like a story element that you're not doing enough with, you know, the idea that he had to make this difficult decision to pull the plug essentially on his daughter when she was in the hospital and on life support. And, you know, it's just kind of randomly in the movie. And I was like, there's not much that develops with this. And especially too, I thought this is going to be something that we see being an impact on the character of his wife, played by Deborah Van Valkenburgh, who's an actress I love. I love seeing her show up in things. And I thought, wow, she's wasted in this movie.
Yeah, she certainly is. And remind me, in your 92 version, do they get back together in the end?
Well, she kind of drops off the map in general. Yeah. I'm trying to remember if there's a big moment at the end there. I don't think there was.
So their marriage is kind of on the rocks. And obviously part of it is because of the trauma of them losing a daughter. The other half of it is him just completely soaking himself in work and just not paying any attention to her. And in both cuts that we've seen, she just kind of leaves at one point and doesn't come back. In the script, there's a subplot where he is up for a judge position. And at the very end of the film, he earns this judge position in the script, and she is there, and they dance, and they almost make up. So that's how it was originally intended. I don't know that that was even ever shot, because it wasn't in any of the versions that I saw. It could be deleted scenes, or it could be something that Friedkin just decided not to do.
Yeah, there's nothing about that definitely in the version that I watch. I mean, in general, I mean, you could tell watching the 92 version that there are things that are not as well thought out, that they're kind of cutting and pasting things like that. One of the weirdest is at the very beginning of the film. And I think I did look up some comparisons online, and I know that this is something that is different between the two versions, but the very first killing that happens in this, we see our killer walking down the street, heading up towards the house. And on the 92 version, there's text that appears on the screen establishing that it's Stockton, California. And then it goes on to say, Christmas Day.
Yeah, Christmas. Planned for a Christmas release.
And there is nothing else that gives any indication that this is Christmas, other than, you know, there's some Christmas decorations on the house and such. But I mean, literally a few seconds later, I was going, wait a second, did I read that wrong? I thought it said it was Christmas Day, because now I'm watching this young woman who's going to become a victim here in a few moments, walking out of her car, carrying a sack full of groceries. And I'm going, the grocery store is open on Christmas Day. Okay. And then, you know, we go into the house and nobody's having any kind of celebration. I mean, granted, not everybody celebrates Christmas, but still, okay. And like later he looks out at the window and there's kids playing around in the yard and stuff. And I'm going, nobody's doing Christmas anything. It's not like they're out there with with the Christmas puppy or something like that. Nothing indicates this is Christmas. So I'm like, this doesn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah, but that part was strange. The actual murders that happened with the vampire killer, I think his name was Richard Chase in Sacramento, happened after Christmas. I think his first murder was around the first of the year. So I don't know why he chose to put that in that version. That certainly, that text was not in the 87 version.
Well, let's talk about kind of those moments involving the killer here, you know, the actual crimes, because I think that's what starts off the movie. And it's, you know, the most kind of, it's the imagery that's going to stick most in your mind, because it does get pretty gruesome. Like we say, we don't see the things actually happen, but we see the aftermath. We see the police and the DA looking into things and investigating, and there are just buckets of blood all over the place. So I guess, does Friedkin go too far here?
It's tough. I mean, the amount of blood that poor cleanup crew had to deal with in the bedroom upstairs in that first house is pretty insane. I think you could see them mopping it, and it's just kind of, it's like something like a pool overflowed, you know? It's mm-hmm. a lot.
Yeah.
Too far, well, though? I mean, you know, it's effective, that's for sure.
It is. I mean, even as we go further into the movie, and there's the scene where the killer escapes for a brief moment and he goes into this church and such, there's a lot of blood in that sequence too, just all over the place, which part of me was going, where did that blood come from? I don't remember in the version that I saw that he actually killed the priest. I don't think that happened. But
he does do that in the 87 version.
And see, that's another thing that threw me, because, you know, what comes right after that is we go to the judge and the district attorney and the defense attorney, and they're talking, and the defense attorney's all about how, well, we can't introduce that he escaped. You know, that has nothing to do with the trial we're doing right now. And I'm going, really? Are you kidding? I mean, even more so if in the other version he actually killed somebody. It was,
yeah,
again, where it feels like parts of this film were kind of cut and paste and there were things that were missing.
That scene where he escapes, so he's in the back of like a police van and he's being escorted. There's two police officers in the back with him. And that must be one of the worst written scenes that I've seen in a very long time. They just turn these police officers into complete dopes, allowing this guy to escape. And that's really the only brutal murder that we see on screen, because I think he puts he puts something into the neck of one of the guards.
He slits one of their throats, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the dumbest scene. And I think the movie would have been a lot stronger had he not escaped and they were just dealing with that first section. I think that would have been way more compelling if they left out that escape portion, because it doesn't add anything to me. It just takes away.
Mm. I agree that the scene with the two cops there where he actually escapes is awkward. I mean, even down to the point where the cops are munching on donuts while this is going on in the back of this van. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's ridiculous that they would not only be eating donuts, but then he's like, can I have one? And
yeah,
it's like, sure, why not? Like, you're going to give this murderer a donut.
Well, and I mean, they're literally yucking it up with the killer here. We're, you know, like, you know, yeah, talking about what does it take to kill somebody like that? All, you know, it's silly.
How does it feel?
But I got to admit, though, I did get a little bit hopeful when he did escape, because there was a part weird that was like, okay, you know, we've had some interesting things happen here with the courtroom stuff. That's fine. But we're going to ramp things up here a little bit. We're getting back into the chase and all that. So, you know, I guess maybe I just like the simple things there, but I was a little bit hopeful when he escaped, but he gets captured right away. You know,
it doesn't go too far. Tries to go anywhere. He just sits in the church and waits for them. And I thought the same thing. I thought, okay, now we're going to turn into a chase movie. But the whole time, it's just building to a courtroom scene at the end, really, is what it's boiling down to.
And I still think, though, where it goes with the courtroom scenes after that, there are definitely some interesting things there. I think one of the most compelling scenes of the movie is the one where you've got Michael Biehn cross-examining the psychiatrist that's there for the defense. And, you know, they're going into the whole what is insanity and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Michael Biehn, we could talk more about Michael Biehn here. I don't think he's the strongest actor. I think this is his best scene in the movie. I think the actor that plays the psychiatrist that he's examining there does a great job in that scene. And, you know, he's just, I mean, he's so cold in his approach to things. You know, you're sitting there going, what's in it for this guy? Why does he so badly want this, you know, want this monster to be declared insane? But yeah, I thought that was the best scene in the movie.
Well, there's a subplot. And again, I don't know if it's in the one you watch, but there's a subplot where these guys from the psychiatric center are afraid that they are going to be held liable for some of this stuff because they let him out when they shouldn't have. And that's kind of their motivation. And that's where you start to feel like, okay, maybe Biehn's got the deck stacked against him when he goes into this. And I agree, that is a great scene. And I also agree that Biehn didn't really bring the full chops to this thing. I normally love him on screen, and in this, he just felt kind of bland.
I agree with that. I think Michael Biehn is very much an actor where he's got to be in the right kind of role. You know, I mean, like, James Cameron knows how to use Michael Biehn. I love him in Tombstone as Johnny Ringo. Here, he is very flat. And really, that scene we were just talking about is the only moment where he really, I think, kind of lets go and we get to see something a bit more interesting. But yeah, he's very bland through most of this film. And I think that is one of the things that frustrated me the most, is because, you know, if we're going to spend so much time with him, so much time in the courtroom and all that, I want to get a bit more into him. I want to get behind this character. And he was just kind of very by the book and not giving me a whole lot of charisma. So that was a bit of a stumbling block for me.
Yeah, it's tough when the person with the most charisma is the murderer. Because as you see in that scene when he's in the back of the van, this dude is affable. He's like, he's a little bit charming at times. And you don't get any of that from Biehn. He's just this really boring dude who is, I guess, trying to get a judge job, but we don't even know that. So, yeah, it was definitely miscast in that role. I would have loved to see somebody with more. Imagine like Ed Harris in that role. It would have been great.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. Well, and while we're on the subject of the killer here, well, I guess the way I'll segue here, this movie is full of people who I was like, oh, my gosh, it's that person. I don't know their name, but I know I've seen them before in other things. And right off the bat here, you know, the first person we see in this movie is our killer. And I was like, I know him from something. So the actor's name, again, Alex MacArthur. I don't know that name. I wouldn't have known what I'd known him from. But the whole time I'm sitting there watching and going, yeah, hey, I know him from something. And finally it hit me. And this, I mean, this happens to me all the time when I'm watching movies. I'm always saying, I know him from something and I don't know what it is. And usually eventually I figure out some movie. And this one was just the weirdest one when I finally realized where I knew him from. But he plays Madonna's boyfriend in the Papa Don't Preach video.
Oh, wow. That's a nice pull.
with Danny Aiello as her father. And I was like, oh, wow, that's just wild. I mean, that's a music video. I mean, you don't hear him talk in that or anything like that. So, you know, this is the first time I've actually seen him, I guess, act. And
memorable face, I guess.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, I thought he did a fine job. I mean, it's not incredible, but I mean, you're right. He's far more charismatic than our DA is. But as far as some of the other folks in this movie too, I thought some of the side characters were interesting. You know, I like seeing folks like, what is his name?
Art LaFleur is the one that got me. Yeah. He's from The Sandlot. He plays Babe Ruth in The Sandlot, which is of course where I know him from.
And of course he's in everything. You know, he's one of those guys that's in tons of stuff. And, he's like this police officer that is kind of working with Biehn and on the investigation, all that. And it was great to see him show up in this. You know, he's just one of those familiar faces that it's always good to see. I had another weird connection when I saw that the father show up, the guy who, you know, he takes one kid off to the dentist, and while he's gone, his wife and other kid get murdered. Okay. This is an actor named Royce Applegate. And again, very familiar face. I was like, I know him from something. And it was weird to have him as the victim in this, because where my brain went, what I connect with him is that he is in a kind of notorious pair of episodes of the show Different Strokes, where he plays a guy who abducts Gary Coleman's little brother, Sam, on the show. That's the redheaded kid that was, he was brought in after Gary Coleman wasn't cute anymore. So they needed a, you know, a cousin Oliver for the show. And they brought in this other kid, but he like abducts Sam. And then, and the reason he does that is because he's lost a child of his own and his wife is grieving. And so he's trying to replace the dead kid. It's one of the most bizarre episodes, pair of episodes, because it's a two-parter and Different Strokes. And so when I saw him pop up in this and he's supposed to be a more sympathetic figure, I was like, oh, that's just weird for me. I don't know if my brain can do that.
I got to check that that pair of episodes out. I actually thought that guy was the best actor in this movie. I really felt for that character in here. Mm.
Yeah, I thought he did a solid job, too. I also got to throw out that the kid, the one that survives, is Whit Hertford, who is the kid who a few years later, Alan Grant would threaten with a raptor claw at the beginning of Jurassic Park.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But then the other kind of main one that stood out for me of the supporting cast is Grace Zabriskie, who plays the mother of the killer. And, you know, she's another one of those people that showed up in a lot of different things. I know David Lynch likes to use her and stuff. She was in Twin Peaks and stuff. But I actually think she gave one of the best performances in this. You know, there were moments where I wondered about her sanity, too, watching the movie.
Yeah, she's got a really good moment at the end of the 87 version where she talks about how in pain she is and how she kicked him out of the house before Christmas because she was afraid that he was going to harm her new puppy. And it's a really, really good moment. I don't know if that transferred over to the 92 version, but it's really
good. It was. Yeah, I think that was in there. Well, I want to talk a bit about the two endings. We kind of hinted that there were, you know, two different, you know, ultimate endings to the film, but I don't think we actually kind of got into the meat of them. Before we do
we
that,
talk about how they wrapped up. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to throw out before we do that, though, and this was one of the biggest surprises for me, but the score is by Ennio Morricone.
Yeah.
I mean, again, for a movie that at times I thought felt like a glorified TV movie, I was like, Ennio Morricone is doing the score. Amazing.
Well, they had worked together on like a TV movie that Friedkin had directed. And as much as he hated The Exorcist 2, which is scored by Morricone as well.
The score is fun, though. That's a fun score.
Well, I like I like the second Exorcist no matter what, but Friedkin was definitely not a fan.
Oh, I like the second Exorcist too for all the wrong reasons. I was actually just talking to a guy about this at work the other day because, you know, there's a new Exorcist movie coming out. And I was like, the first Exorcist is a masterpiece. The second one is bad, but it's entertaining for all the right reasons, all the wrong reasons, I should say. And Exorcist 3 is way better than it has any right being, you know.
I love Exorcist 3 as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about the endings here. You know, I'll let you go into detail on yours, because from what I've seen of things, I think the version that you watched is the better ending. Because the one I watched almost felt like there wasn't an ending at all. Because we basically have the killer found guilty, and we go through that scene where they talk about, you know, he goes through the scan and we see that he does have issues with the brain and so he is, you know, insane, whatever. Okay. And we close by, we kind of are jumping back and forth between cuts where we see the father whose wife and son were murdered with his one son that survived in a carnival, and they're having fun together. They're talking about moving out of town, starting a new life and that. And we intercut that with moments of the killer behind bars, and he's writing a letter to them and telling them to come visit him. And then it ends with a title card that says he's scheduled for parole hearing in 6 months, which, I mean, yeah, that's not a happy ending at all there. But when that was done, I literally was sitting in there going, that's it?
Yeah.
That's not an ending. But I think yours sounds a bit better.
Yeah, in the 87 version, you do get an ending. So you get that PET scan scene like we mentioned, and Bean sees that there's visible abnormalities, and he kind of runs out of there like, oh my God, I've made a mistake. But by the time he gets to the cell, the killer has killed himself with an overdose of pills that his mother had slipped him. So he, you know, it's how did you let this happen? I don't know. And then we end on the same carnival with the dad and the son having a good time. And then it just kind of ends right there. But it has a definitive ending because the killer is dead.
It's wild. That's, I mean, such a difference between the two endings there.
Yeah. And it's weird that he shot both of them prior to, and then just decided to use one 5 years later that was completely different.
That's nuts. It's nuts. Well, we need to start moving towards the break here, but I guess any final thoughts? I mean, you know, a lot of people are revisiting Friedkin's films here as, you know, they're kind of looking back after his passing. Is this one they should seek out? Is this just for the completists? What do you think?
Oh, man, it's hard to recommend this if you're big into Friedkin, but it's definitely not his strongest film. I definitely think it's interesting. I would love to see a Blu-ray come out. Like we talked about, this has never been on disc in the United States. Only one DVD available in Poland. Some company has to pick this up. I think that the Miramax catalog is with Paramount right now, so there is a chance that we will see it at some point. But a nice version that looks good with both cuts and some special features. You know what? I'd probably buy that. I'd probably buy that to check it all out. As is right now, where all we get are kind of low-quality VHS rips, if you're lucky enough to find the 92 version on DVD, hard to recommend.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't know that I can recommend it. I do think it would be interesting to watch, you know, both versions and you know, kind of get a better impression of what the differences were. And I think certainly if you're interested in looking at Friedkin's whole career, yeah, this is an interesting curiosity, but yeah, I think there's an awful lot of moments here as you watch this that you just, again, are kind of going, this is the same guy that did Sorcerer? Wow.
Yep. And you know he still had it, because in 2011, like I said, Killer Joe, man, he's back on that one.
Well, all right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another LAMB Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it. That's just
how it works. Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support this show through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
As everyone knows, rainbows usually have a treasure at the end. Let's follow this one and see if we can find the pot of gold.
I suppose you've come to claim me treasure.
Well, we'd like to see the gold first.
Nathan, there's better than gold in here, me lad. No, just look here, no.
Candy, refreshing soft drinks, popcorn, ice cream. Well, that's some treasure, but anyone can buy luscious treats like these at the snack bar.
You don't tell me. Do you suppose you could get me a job as a snack bar attendant?
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie, something we want to spread the word about. It might be a forgotten film, it might be an old classic, might be something new in the theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Jason, what is your recommendation?
All right, when I do double features, I look for themes. Forgotten film had to be one of my themes for this. I looked for the young serial killer with questionable motives and something with an insane opening. And I'm going to recommend 1977's Roller Coaster. Are you familiar with this one?
I am familiar with this one. It is not one I have had the opportunity to catch up with yet, but I desperately want to see it.
A lot of parallels. It's about this again, pretty boy young guy that decides that he is going to hold a bunch of roller coaster magnates ransom by randomly putting bombs on their roller coasters across the country. It has one of the wildest openings. And the poster, I think, had allusions to this is the second coming of Hitchcock. It is not that. But I tell you what, if you aren't sweating by the time that opening is done, then you need to get your pores checked, because it is it's a really exciting opening. It stars George Segal in a really great role as like a safety inspector that's trying to figure out what this guy's doing. But it's got some really great sequences, and I think it has a lot of parallels here. And then for you, man, you got to check out Killer Joe. You got to close that Friedkin loop when you get a chance.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Roller Coaster has been on my list for a long time. I just haven't been able to get a hold of a copy. You know, I think part of what appeals to me about it is that I have had dreams, you know, where like I'm on something at a amusement park that goes haywire. I don't remember a dream with a roller coaster, but I remember, you know, those ones with the swings that spin around. Like, I remember dream where like that went nuts and, you know, people were flying off and stuff. So yeah, this movie sounds like a nightmare of mine come to life. So definitely got to check that out. Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, I decided to go with another Friedkin film. And, you know, since we were talking about a forgotten Friedkin film, I'm going to go with another one that I think is very much a forgotten film from William Friedkin. It's actually his first film. It's called Good Times. It was released in 1969, and it is the big screen debut of Sonny and Cher. So this is basically Sonny and Cher, the movie. The idea here is that they play themselves, and they are being given the chance to star in a movie. There's this producer played by George Sanders. He wants to put them in a movie. So they have to figure out what kind of movie they're going to be in. So most of the movie has them imagining themselves in various movie genres. You know, they do a Western, and there's a sequence where they're doing like a Tarzan thing, and then there's a detective sequence. So they're kind of inserting themselves into all these different classic film genres. And of course, there's lots of songs peppered throughout. You know, they were a popular musical act, so you got to have that there. One of the things I think is really fun about this movie, and funny about the movie, and I guess spoiler alert, but it's not that big of a spoiler. At the end of the movie, Sonny and Cher decide they don't want to do a movie because they don't want to look silly. One of the things that I think is so wonderful about this movie is that they are not afraid to look silly. This is a silly movie. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of a precursor to the variety shows that they would end up doing on TV in the 70s. These different vignettes of the movie, you could look at them as being like the comedy skits on a variety show. And, you know, so I definitely think that when the idea for doing a weekly comedy variety show in the 70s came up, that this was kind of something they might have pointed towards and says, hey, look, it worked here. I mean, ultimately, I think the movie is actually pretty funny. It's pretty creative. It's actually got a lot of visual creativity to it. You know, I don't know how much of that is Friedkin. I don't know how much he was kind of involved in crafting this or if he was just a director for hire or what. It's definitely an odd entry in his filmography. But when I watched it, I had an awful lot of fun with it. And I thought, well, looky there. The director of The Exorcist has a funny side.
I'll have to check that out. I know he had a documentary before that, and then he did some work for The Twilight Zone and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. It's so weird that he would choose that as his first real narrative film.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Jason, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your podcast.
Thanks so much. Yeah, anywhere you're listening to this, you can find Force 5. It's the Force 5 podcast, force5podcast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Force5Pod.
All right, great. Thanks again for being on the show. And I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that brings us to the end of episode 197 of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. Of course, you'll find other reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.